Welcome to Groundwire, newscast of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association. Today's episode is produced at CJSF-FM, Burnaby, BC. In lieu of headlines, one big headline, Occupy Canada.
I'm happy to say
that the whole damn continent is occupied.
With the Occupy Wall Street movement just over a month old, as the Arab Spring revolutions see the elimination of century-old dictatorships, and as the global effort of Occupy Together finishes its first week, Groundwire goes across Canada to review the people's movement. Starting in the East Coast, where in Halifax, people continue to occupy Grand Parade Square.
I have been here since Saturday, and basically pretty much from the beginning. Now, I'm not every night I've stayed here. I've been here till midnight every night. It's good. I mean, it's a community. So there's been ups and downs. Actually, it's more than a community. A lot of us are very much family now, and I've just met all of them pretty much in the last 3 weeks. So with family, sometimes they're tired. It's cold. It's wet. It's hard. It's a lot of work building this.
In Montreal, people from all walks of life have been occupying Victoria Square, later renamed the People's Square, and encouraging people to fight for a truly democratic and just way of life, including well-known environmentalist David Suzuki.
The big question to me is this really a moment? Is this our Middle Eastern moment when people are rising up and saying we've got to take back our country, take back our democracy, which I don't think we have now, and stop serving the corporate agenda? Seems like money is everything that determines what our priorities are now, and money, the economy, is just a means to something else, surely. The economy by itself is nothing. We use the economy for something else. Do we want justice? Do we want greater equity? Do we want environmental protection? Those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in, and if that's part of what this movement is, it's a very exciting moment.
Many reports on the Occupy movement have highlighted the diversity of people who are protesting. In Toronto, some occupiers have expressed an optimism concerning the number of youth at occupations and their ability in this movement to address issues that have long been ignored.
Sid Ryan, President of the Ontario Federation of Labour. We're out here today, the labour movement, because the issues that are being spoken about here today are exactly the same issues that we've been talking about for decades. Corporate greed, our jobs being shipped overseas, young people graduating from university with massive debt loads and no real jobs to graduate into, people concerned about affordable housing. These are all the issues that we've been talking about for many decades, and it's great to see so many young people are getting it and they're growing a movement that's more organic than what we would normally have in the labour movement, less hierarchy involved in the decision-making process, and you can see it's working, you know. People, there's a real good feel here today. There's a sense of purpose and a determination and energy in this protest that I think is going to go a long way towards developing a social movement that will put pressure on Bay Street and put pressure on politicians to start thinking about people in this country and start thinking about, once again, creating some jobs back here at home, decent paying jobs that can allow people to retire with dignity, for example, or provide them with a decent, their kids with a decent education. So there's a lot of issues here that are coming to the fore that we've been trying to breathe life into for quite some time, and I think this young movement here today is doing just that.
Many occupations, including Occupy Ottawa and Occupy Vancouver, emphasized the issue that as Canadians, we live on occupied land, and that we cannot ignore our history of colonization.
So as we begin Occupy Ottawa, we want to acknowledge that Ottawa is already occupied. We are on occupied Algonquin land. And we want to honor that. And thank the Algonquin people for being here. Thank you.
We're on native land here, man. Everything is native land. Ever since 1492, we've been discussing this, and we haven't gotten anywhere. But we all understand here, I think everybody does, that we're on native land. I think the native peoples would like their support also with the fight that, or whatever we're having, the conflict we were having with the system. I believe these people here are against the corporate system, as we are, but we are also caretakers of the land, and I think it's more vital for us to take care of the land. It's going to take them a long time to get rid of this corporate garbage that's going on, just as it has been taking us as long to get our places rectified at the UN. But we're getting there, we're making progress, and it's taken 500 years to mess us up. We're almost there to a point now where we are starting to be acknowledged as the First Nations of this people and gaining a little bit more power as to what needs to be raped and pillaged amongst us. There's too much greed going on, there's too much raping and pillaging, and I think that Native peoples, the non-Native people, should understand that this place, they took it as a Garden of Eden when they landed, and I think if they gave it some sort of recognition and understanding towards Native peoples, we can once again bring this back to the Garden of Eden for everybody, where we can share everything.
In Saskatoon, some activists emphasized the importance of discussion as a means of finding solutions.
So what I see Occupy Saskatoon as, and all the occupations really, is neighborhoods can get together one time, like for 3 hours a month, and they can talk to each other and they can say what's wrong, what can we do about it, like how can we resolve these issues. But what we're doing is kind of inviting everybody here, and we're saying let's have this conversation 24 hours a day and try and find people that are like concerned about the same issues as you. Get together with them, talk to them, and see what you can come up with. Identify the problems and see how you can make solutions.
For the time being, discussions continue in all of the occupations taking place on the continent. Occupiers are becoming more organized and building strong communities that seek to put a focus on people instead of profit.
Thanks to Alana McNevin of CKUT Montreal and the following media co-op producers: Tom Morello, Vancouver; Glenn Canning, Halifax; Tim McSorley, Montreal; Youth in Solidarity, Toronto; Greg McDougall and Wawaskesh in Ottawa; The Stimulator in Vancouver; and Heather Martin in Saskatoon. You're listening to Groundwire. Now on to our other features. We have two distinct views of the Missing and Murdered Women inquiry taking place in Vancouver. First, here's Justin Lansley with highlights from inside.
On October 11, 2011, the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry began its first evidentiary hearing almost 4 years after serial killer Robert Picton was convicted of the murders of six women. Due to the BC Attorney General Department's refusal to fund lawyers for advocacy groups at the inquiry, concerns have been raised that the inquiry would favor police and government institutions over street-level voices. Over a dozen nonprofit groups have withdrawn from the process, including the BC Civil Liberties Association and Amnesty International. Two of the remaining groups were represented on October 12th by Grand Chief and lawyer Edward John, who spoke on behalf of the First Nations Summit, and Anne Livingston on behalf of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Of the First Nations Summit, we began to hear stories of and receive information about and including names of Aboriginal women going missing and or being murdered in the downtown Vancouver, downtown east side. And the Commission Council yesterday referred to this as well. It appeared to us that despite continuous serious efforts by some individuals and organizations, no authorities were paying much attention to them or the issues they were raising. Given that we are a First Nations political organization, some of these individuals and organizations came to us for advice and support. After all, many of these missing women are Aboriginal and come from our communities across this province and across this country. In supporting and working with them, we fought for this issue to be taken seriously by the provincial government, local police, and various public agencies. In January 1997, the First Nations Summit Chiefs formally called for an investigation into the multiple murders of Aboriginal women in Vancouver, setting out a list of 48 women believed to be of Aboriginal ancestry. The following month, we contacted the Attorney General, then Ujjal Dosanjh, seeking his intervention and support in appointing a special investigator to examine the cases on an urgent and priority basis. We also work to raise public awareness about this issue in the media and by being involved with those Aboriginal First Nations organizations in the downtown east side who came forward and approached the chiefs in British Columbia for support. It was not until June 1997 that the Attorney General responded to us advising that the Unsolved Homicide Unit had been established and that it had been provided the list of names we provided and that the unit was looking into this matter. The Vancouver Police Department advised the First Nations Summit that a number of other names had been added to the list, to altogether 71.
That was Grand Chief Edward John of the First Nations Summit at the Missing Women Inquiry on Wednesday, October 12th. Also that day, Executive Director Anne Livingston, on behalf of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, VANDU, argued the importance of the vulnerability of victims from illegal drug use and emphasized consideration on the role of the war on drugs relating to the conditions leading to the victims' deaths.
The women who went missing were often people who use illegal drugs. VANDU would like the role of the illegal drug market to be a central consideration when examining how the women were so vulnerable to violence and murder, how the women were criminalized by their drug addiction and poverty, how the police completely disregarded them as worthy of protection and help, how other social agencies and community facilities excluded the women from their programs and buildings in the downtown east side, how the women became so degraded, how the women could be lured to their deaths with illegal drugs, how the court system sets the women up to fail with endless court appointments, probation appointments, and warrants, and more warrants for missing those appointments. We would request that the role of the illegal drug market and the war on drugs be a central consideration when examining how women avoiding arrest became more important to our women than preserving their health. At different points in the 1990s, there were warrant checks at emergency rooms where women were trying to remember fake names they could give while they were doubled over in pain. Welfare now asks for a warrant, whether you have a warrant on every single monthly check, you figure you have to take that off. Housing is often eliminated for people in this position. So we want the war on drugs to be a central consideration when examining how they gave up on life, how these women gave up on life, because of the persecution of child protection services, which deliberately set them up to fail as mothers. The pain of this unnatural loss fuels even more increased drug use amongst drug-using women. We want this commission to look at how the war on drugs is a central consideration when examining how detox and drug addiction treatment services fail the most marginalized, most addicted, and street-involved drug addicts. We want them to consider this on how welfare intimidates the very people it was hopefully set up to serve by constantly criminalizing the women with threats of drug testing for welfare checks.
That was Executive Director Anne Livingston of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users at the Missing Women Inquiry on Wednesday, October 12th, preceded by Grand Chief Edward John.
The most vociferous criticism of the Missing and Murdered Women Inquiry takes place daily in the street outside the hearings. Julie Ngoh took a recorder to the corner of Georgia and Granville Streets in Vancouver to find out what the protesters could tell.
October 19, 2011. This was the sixth day of the Missing Women Inquiry demonstration. Protesters from the downtown Eastside Women's Center were accusing the justice system of failure to include Aboriginal women's rights in the inquiry. One of the protesters, Georgina, who was a former prostitute, spoke out on behalf of these women.
The woman kept going missing all the time. The police wouldn't do nothing about it. And so I joined women's organizations and I started fighting and raising awareness for these missing women, but nobody would do anything about it. As Aboriginal Women's Action Network, AWON, we wrote to the UN a CEDAW report a couple of years ago, and the report went over there and all the countries of the world shamed Canada and said, how could you let this go on in your country? And so Canada had no other choice but to have an inquiry. And so Wally Opal said that we would be included in the talks because we were the ones that called for this. And in the end, we weren't included because we don't have the money it takes to sit in there every day with a lawyer. But yet Wally Opal's paying himself $1,500 a day to sit there. And the women up there are going hungry. The families up there are hungry. Those families need support, so we're continuing to stay here and support those families of the Picton family that are in there right now. They're the only ones that are in there right now. They paid for a lawyer for the Picton families, but not for everybody else to have a voice. So in the end, our voices aren't heard anyway.
Lisa Yeloko from the Barter Women's Support Services has fought for the Aboriginal women's rights for years, also protested for the truth and justice that the missing women's friends and families deserve.
Women's Inquiry upstairs is not getting the truth, and they're getting a fabricated truth, and it's no different than the trial itself. It's, you know, it's been staged. It's, you know, there's the select people participating. I want to, you know, bring that into the consciousness of Canadians, because, you know, if we're continuing to oppress the original peoples of this territory, which are the roots and foundation of this country, then, you know, then how do we ever seek justice and sovereignty and, you know, self-determination and agency in this country? I mean, and that includes anybody. If our foundation is corrupt and based on violence against the Aboriginal women in this community or in this country, then, you know, and yeah, so, you know, basically that's why, you know, we're here. We want the rest of Canada to care. We want them to care.
As the women kept on missing, Monica, who saw the van picking up those women on the street in exchange for drugs, reported what she witnessed to the police, but her credibility was denied. She expressed her anger and frustration toward the prejudice against her status as an Aboriginal woman.
And over time, I've grown to know who I am as a First Nations woman. I'm not a piece of dirt. I'm not a dirty Indian, and I'm not somebody that can be kicked around. And I matter today. And those systems, that judicial system, those lawyers, those representatives, and those police officers were all part of that system that oppressed me. And how did they oppress me? They abused me. They pushed me around, and they tried to keep me quiet. And they distinctly told me that I would never amount to anything. Word for word, those were the words that were told to me and spoken to me by the court system, by the lawyers, you know, by the police officers. They would share that with me. They would say, you know what, you're not worth anything, you know.
The protesters are hoping that this demonstration can raise Canada's awareness of the long-existing racism and casteism within the system. They are determined to persistently continue the protests until January 2012. Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Julie Ngo.
And I'm Sean Fan. The group Engineers Without Borders uses engineering knowledge to help with problems in the developing world. Here's their latest campaign.
Canada contributes $5 billion in annual spending for international aid with little accountability to the public. With this in mind, Engineers Without Borders is launching a campaign for transparency by urging Canada to join with a growing group of leading nations in signing on to the International Aid Transparency Initiative. Here to tell you more is Grace McEwen, co-president of the SFU Burnaby chapter of Engineers Without Borders, in an interview with CJSF's Anastasia Shevchenko.
Okay, so if you're up on campus at SFU, you've probably seen boxes accumulating in Convo Mall over the past week. They are a physical representation of the way Canada does aid right now. So CEDA, which is the Canadian International Development Agency, gives money to various countries and organizations to use for development. And the way they give the money is very untransparent. So mm-hmm. it's very difficult for people to go and see what CETA is doing. And even within CETA, people from different branches will have a very difficult time finding out what the other branches are doing and where money is going. So it's a very ineffective system.
Very bureaucratic, sounds.
Yes. So to improve the system, we're asking that Canada sign on to the International Aid Transparency Initiative, which is abbreviated the IATI. And there's quite a lot of countries that have already signed on, and the World Bank and some other multinational organizations as well. Basically, it's a standard where people have to report their data in a certain format, and they have to report specific things, and they can report other stuff on top of that, but there's a minimum amount of information that they have to report. Mm-hmm. When people can see where the money is going, it's much easier to hold organizations accountable to spending that money effectively. Because if you know how much money someone has, you can ask for where are the results that this money came from. It's also, if people in developing countries know how much their country is getting, it reduces the ability of their government to be corrupt and to take aid money for themselves, because they can see that they are receiving this aid money.
That's so true. And I bet it's a big problem for a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. So if we could prevent that, I think it's our responsibility to do that.
I would agree. So we're going to be having people send postcards and emails and letters to their MPs and to Bev Oda, sending postcards to her to ask Canada to sign on to the International Aid Transparency Initiative. Mm-hmm. And we believe that the time right now is like the opportune time to sign on, because mm-hmm. there's a high-level aid effectiveness forum happening at the end of November in South Korea, and we want Canada to sign on before that so that we can encourage other countries to sign on and show leadership in the global domain. We're having these events all across the country to show that Canadian citizens really do care about this issue. We want to get the government's attention and media's attention. Emailing or writing a letter to your MP, or even taking another step and going and talking to them about these issues, really shows that you care again. And if you look at the Engineers Without Borders website, there's a link that makes it very easy to send an email to your MP.
What is the website again?
It is ewb.ca. If you Google Engineers Without Borders Canada, you will find it.
And thanks to Bea Bernhausen for putting that story together. Lastly, here's GroundWire's Community Radio Report. October 30th will not be World Radio Day. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, has been polling to see if its member states would support the declaration of a World Radio Day. Bruce Gerard, a Canadian with his roots in community radio, was one of the two researchers who surveyed UNESCO's members about the day.
The Spanish Radio Academy proposed the 30th of October as the date for World Radio Day, and they've been campaigning for this for a number of years. But when we first received the proposal, we were a little bit dubious about the appropriateness of the 30th of October. It was the day that Orson Welles broadcast his famous War of the Worlds radio play, which when that was broadcast on the 30th of October, it was broadcast as if it was an actual newscast about an invasion from Mars. And it succeeded in convincing a lot of people that it was true and causing a good deal of panic in the United States. And so we thought, well, maybe that wasn't the best message to put across about a World Radio Day, basically the first day that radio lied massively and created public panic. Personally, one of the things that I first thought of was Radio Milcolin, the radio stations in Rwanda, which created massive panic by putting out lies, which eventually led to terrible genocide. Anyway, so we put out two other options. One was the birth date of Reginald Fessenden. Reginald Fessenden was from Quebec, and he was the inventor of audio broadcasting, and he broadcast the very first radio program that included voice, music, recorded music and live music. He played his violin, he read from the Bible, and he played some recorded Christmas music on December 24th, 1906. Which December 24th wasn't a very good day for a World Radio Day, so we decided to propose October 6th, which was Reginald Fessenden's birthday. And we also proposed the 27th of July, which was the first public demonstration of wireless broadcasting by Marconi in 1896. Both the 6th of October and the 27th of July received a lot of good responses by the people we surveyed. And UNESCO proposed as an alternative date the anniversary of the founding of United Nations Radio, which is basically a radio production unit within the United Nations. It was founded on 13th of February.
That's how February 13th, 2012 could be the first World Radio Day, if UNESCO approves the proposal at its conference in November. Based on preliminary consultation, its chances look pretty good.
We did this consultation with something like 418 people worldwide, from 114 different countries and from, you know, from the Arab regions, from Africa, Asia, Latin America, Europe, North America. And one of the things that we discovered, and it's very interesting because we're just getting over the, or we're still in the middle of the changes that are going on in the Arab world, where media are suddenly becoming more free in many countries. The respondents from the Arab states to the survey, 100% of them supported the declaration of World Radio Day. In Africa and Asia, 97%. In Latin America, which is a little bit more developed and a little bit more, there were more media available than in Africa and Asia, 91%. And Europe and North America, interestingly, were the places that that provided least support to the idea of a World Radio Day. It still was a substantial amount of support, 83%. But I remember 10, 12 years ago, we held a meeting of radio broadcasters from North and South America. And one of the conclusions that we came to at that meeting was that, you know, while radio is still the most vibrant and most important medium available, especially for rural communities in Latin America, in the United States and Canada, radio is often just something that you get for free when you buy a car.
Despite competition from other media in Canada, community radio especially continues to grow. Bruce Gerard first got into Canadian community radio in 1982 at Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and he organized the first major conference of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, in 1986. He also served on the first board of directors of the National Campus and Community Radio Association of Canada, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary in November.
I remember we were always struggling to try to exist and trying to pull together a little bit of money to do something and that kind of thing. And I'm very pleased to see the changes that that's happened in NCRA and in community radio in general in Canada. The Community Radio Fund, for example, is something that's providing a lot of inspiration to people outside of Canada around the world, seeing that that kind of thing can actually happen, actually work, and make a big contribution to the sector, and probably even more importantly, allow the sector to make a bigger contribution to the media environment of the whole country.
Bruce Gerard, Canadian community radio veteran, interviewed by phone from his office in Uruguay. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Werden. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association of Canada, www.ncra.ca. The national newscast comes out every 2 weeks. This week's show was produced at CJSF-FM, Burnaby, B.C. In addition to those already credited, Groundwire thanks Groundwire volunteer coordinators Carly Forbes in Guelph and Sam Kriviak in Alberta.